What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation.
Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. At one time, the typical U.S. discovery exercise involved domestic rules, a set of documents primarily in English, and little concern for individual privacy rights. But as modern organizations continue to reap the benefits of rampant globalization, intricate multinational discovery disputes have become commonplace. Among countries considering or adopting e-discovery privacy or data protection rules, the APAC region lies on the cusp of the frontier. I am pleased today to kick off an international ESI report with Jason Velasco and Kate Chan, here to talk today about APAC e-discovery developments. Jason Velasco, co-founder and analyst of the eDiscovery Journal, has more than 15 years of legal and eDiscovery experience and has spoken and written specifically on the legal complexities presented by the emerging Asian eDiscovery market. Kate Chan is a managing director for Kroll On Track and is based in Hong Kong and comes to us from Japan today. Kate and Jason, thanks so much for joining me on this edition of the ESI Report.
Thanks, Michelle.
My pleasure.
So let's go ahead and kick it off. Kate and Jason, even though you are half a world apart, with Jason coming to us from Texas and, like I said, Kate dialing in from Japan, you both had the opportunity to meet in person last summer, the summer of 2013, when Jason traveled to Asia to speak on e-discovery topics. Jason, maybe you can kick things off with just some observations about e-discovery in Asia based on your travels to the region and based on your expertise of e-discovery in the U.S. Just some brief remarks on what you thought when you were over in Asia learning about e-discovery.
Well, thanks, Michelle, and I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss the topic with you. I had some clients over the last couple of years ask some questions around the challenges of dealing with e-discovery in the APAC region. I've always been very interested in the international side of e-discovery, you know, dealing with privacy laws and cross-border challenges to getting data into the United States. And so this was a wonderful research topic for me to pick up as an analyst. So, and I had the opportunity to visit Hong Kong to attend the e-discovery exchange hosted by InXL. I jumped at the chance to be able to meet and greet with people that are participating in the community there, both as practitioners as well as consumers in the marketplace. And what I found very interesting was the development of e-discovery in that particular marketplace. It seemed like most of the people that I spoke to were still relatively new to the e-discovery marketplace. And as you mentioned earlier in your opening remarks, Michelle, there's a pretty standard workflow that we have in the U.S. for dealing with English documents and the review workflow and things along those lines. You know, but that doesn't really, you know, in the Asian marketplace, they've been able to really glean and learn a lot from our mistakes in the early days of e-discovery. So what we found is that the market there was extremely young. In fact, part of my research discovered that about 50% of the people that are practitioners in the e-discovery marketplace in Asia only have about 1 to 3 years of experience, which I'm sure is significantly different from here in the United States. We also learned quite a bit about the fact that, you know, they're responding mostly to U.S. and EU litigation as part of their e-discovery projects. It really doesn't come from litigation in Asia. It's coming from outside request. So I thought those things were an interesting start to the day. We learned a little bit more, but I'm sure we'll talk about that throughout the podcast.
Thanks. So, Kate, maybe I'll turn it over to you. Given that you are living and working in Asia, maybe you could give listeners just a quick survey of some of the country-specific laws that are most prominent in the region. Give us a flavor of how, for example, e-discovery laws and practices differ in Singapore versus Hong Kong versus Japan, most of us will never get a chance to travel to Asia. A little bit of visibility into how e-discovery works would be great.
Sure. I must agree, though, with Jason's earlier comment, though, that most of the e-discovery work that we do out here and handle for multinational clients are driven by the U.S. courts and the EU courts. But specifically, the e-discovery does exist through the various countries that are out here, just in a different magnitude. For example, Japan's a civil law jurisdiction and does not, in general practice, e-discovery, but some of its fair trade commissions are now frequently still asking for production of data while they go through regulatory review of business practices. So even though it's not generally part of the practice of law, you know, the government is becoming aware that it is a great source of evidence for them to gather. And then in Singapore and Hong Kong, both former British colonies, so you would guess that they are, in fact, both common law jurisdictions. The thing with both of these locales, or city-states, if you will, is that they do have limited scopes of discovery. But Singapore is actually the pioneer. It, as of 2009, had already drafted a opt-in e-discovery code where it provided great guidance for anyone working within its courts to produce documents in electronic format. Hong Kong itself, in the meantime, is a little bit behind, values quick and efficient discovery, high transparency, in fact, and is only at this point, as of 2014, in the process of drafting a pilot scheme for discovery and inspection of electronically stored documents. And you're right, I do happen to be involved in a working group of practitioners, law practitioners, as well as e-discovery providers who are commenting on this particular practice direction that is schemed for going into execution in the next month or so.
It sounds like understanding the local intricacies for anyone that's having to either collect or produce documents originating from Asia, it's very important to understand what you're doing, perhaps even more so than an e-discovery exercise that just is all based in the U.S. or North America. Jason, maybe you could give us some practical tips for listeners should they have a case, and maybe they have years of e-discovery experience in the States. What are some things that they should know should their case have an APEC component?
Well, I think the first practical tip is make sure you're always engaging local counsel in some kind. I mean, as Kate mentioned, the laws in each one of these regions are different. They're emerging and they're very much changing rapidly, in some cases within a case. So just make sure you're engaging with local counsel. The other thing that I would highly recommend is, you know, the fact that we're dealing with multilingual languages is very much a challenge. I hear a lot of providers say that they're quote unquote Unicode compliant, which means that they can take Unicode data, you know, which in some cases can handle multiple languages. But it really is much more than that. There's a significant amount of complexities in dealing with CJK or Chinese, Japanese, Korean languages that really require a lot more expertise than just running it through a standard indexing system and hoping for the best when you do a keyword search. So it really takes a lot of details, and you want to really vet out the providers that you're working with in that particular area when dealing with CJK languages. We have a lot of folks that say, well, we could just go ahead and run it through a translation tool. Well, you know, the translation accuracy rate is really only about 60 to 65% even what they call machine translation. In fact, as part of our research, you know, we discovered that many people, when they're dealing with projects in Asia, that, you know, they prefer to use native reviewers in their own country as part of the review workflow. A lot of that is because, as Kate could probably attest to, is that, you know, local reviewers are familiar with, you know, the dialects, some cultural nuances that even a bilingual person that's trained in the U.S. may not understand. So, you know, I do recommend ensuring that when you put in your workflow that you're just not assuming that using a translation tool will get you what you need. The other thing that I've found as an emerging trend is the use of predictive technologies dealing with multilingual documents. There's a process called tokenization, which basically parses out the words and the nuances within a CJK document. You know, predictive technologies are very efficient at handling those, especially if we're doing things like first pass review and triaging the data. And we're actually seeing a higher adoption rate and a faster adoption rate in Asia, even more so than in the United States. So some of the practical tips are making sure that you have a solid project management team that is very familiar with multilingual documents is going to be critical to success of these type of projects.
Kate, do you have anything to add based on your experiences, any additional practicalities for U.S. practitioners involved in Asia e-discovery?
Well, I think Jason touches on the key point in that localization is really important, whether you're talking about your legal team or the people who will help you from a technical perspective or the people who guide you through the entire process, namely your project management team. So having these people who are aware of, you know, what the data sources might be, the intricacies of how you collect and how you review is going to be really key. So like when you consider the types of data sources, different companies in these cultures have different ways of storing their data, you know, different types of shared drives that might, you know, be out of, not of norm in the United States and elsewhere in the Western world. And also specifically, it seems, we're noticing quite a bit of paper that is already a dying breed in the U.S., but there's still quite a bit of paper source data that still exists here. And so very important when thinking through to make sure that paper data is captured as well and that, you know, it's properly OCR'd and you've got, you know, good access to it. But beyond that, one of the key things is just be respectful of the people who you might be working with. The cultures are different. It would be good to have more thorough custodian interviews and be able to work with management within the company and all the teams that are decision makers to understand how and best to properly access and get, you know, everything that is needed.
And one thing, Kate, as a follow-up is, you know, one of the things that I saw, you know, was on the collection side, and that's usually where a lot of the questions I get from consumers in the marketplace is, what is the appropriate collection approach? And when I went to Asia over the summer, I kept hearing we should make forensic images of all of the hard drives and the systems. And that's actually a very important point. I was very much at the forefront of active data collections here in the United States, you know, versus making a forensic images of 1,000 computers. But I think that is very different in Asia, and I think people should be aware of that. In Asia, you know, there's a significant more use of encrypted data. And typically, you only get one bite at the apple in terms of collecting information. You know, a lot of the times the data is in remote locations, or the custodians who aren't used to over-collecting like we do here in the United States are not willing to, you know, you have repeated access to their potential workstations. So, you know, making forensic images is actually an important key, and listening to the arguments of the folks and the practitioners in the Asian marketplace, it really changed my mind specifically to that region. Because, I mean, again, when you're dealing with, you know, most of your cases are either internal investigations or involving government investigations, you know, that has always been one of my recommendations of making forensic images of key custodians. So that is very much in line with the current Asian practitioner's thought process.
You know, those tips that you guys provided, they're invaluable because, again, we tend to have a little bit of tunnel vision and tunnel thinking that e-discovery will be the same no matter where we are in the world. And certainly the things that you both have pointed out are proof positive that that's not necessarily the case. Jason, any concluding remarks before we have a little bit of fun on the ESI report?
Sure. I think just one, which is, you know, be careful about the transferring of data from APAC over into the United States. You know, in the People's Republic of China, or PRC, they have a concept called state secrets. And basically, that's defined specifically only by the state of China, and it can be retroactive. So be very, very cautious and just don't assume that you either have a hosted environment where lawyers and review teams in the U.S. can access the data, or sending over the hard drives or the collected data directly from, you know, the client site. Just be very, very cautious. And it goes back to tip number one, which is make sure you're including local counsel in all these decisions, because they're really going to be able to guide you the best way.
Well, thank you for that. I think our listeners will find both of your remarks completely invaluable. If you guys are game, I always try to have a little bit of fun because e-discovery doesn't always have to be serious. I've got some, what I like to call maybe a Festival of Nations Jeopardy. For those of you in the U.S. that are familiar with the show Jeopardy, it's just a little bit of a fast facts that are related to strange laws coming out of some various Asian countries. In the United States, it's somewhat urban legend and somewhat strange laws, but I know there are lots of unique and interesting things that are still on the books. For example, it's urban legend that you can't cross state lines here from Minnesota to Wisconsin, where I'm based, with a chicken or a duck on your head. Just random strange laws, but these are actual strange laws. I did a little bit of trivia, and if you guys are game, I'm expecting some zealous gamesmanship to figure out which country has these strange laws. You guys up for it?
I'm in.
Kate's going to be the local expert, so we'll test her knowledge of strange Asian laws. We'll start with an easier one, and they get harder. This country maintains a ban on the importation of any chewing gum. However, rest assured, there is a carve-out for chewing gum with therapeutic value. Which Asian country?
Singapore?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Singapore. That was fast, Kate. You didn't even give Jason a chance.
Actually, I was thinking Malaysia or Singapore, so that's dead on.
Sorry, I'm not playing the rules.
Singapore maintains a ban on chewing gum. Kate, any comments on that? Have you been to Singapore?
I have. We work there frequently and have local offices. But, you know, people have been caned for, you know, sticking chewing gum in public places and not taking care of their refuse properly. So it's a strict country.
With some strict laws, apparently. How about another one? This one's harder, and the last one's even harder. So in 2013, several news sources reported statements made by this APAC country's government that amounted really to a total ban on buying or selling bitcoins, which is an online currency. And so it's really a murky question in this country regarding the potential use of bitcoin and its possible link to any illicit activity. Which country is on the cutting edge of banning any sort of online currency?
I'm going to take a wild guess, but if I remember correctly, I think I saw something about that in Thailand.
I was thinking China.
You know, Jason is right. It's Thailand. Thailand has cracked down on anything that has to do with Bitcoin and is trying to keep some of, like I said, the illicit activity down by banning any exchange. Like I said, it's a murky question right now in Thailand with the use of Bitcoin for anyone that's using that online currency. Good job, Jason.
Well, thank you.
All right, one last question. This one's hard, I think, but in a commonly known as the first country to go smoke-free, this APAC country passed a Tobacco Control Act in 2010 that makes the manufacture, supply, distribution, sale, and purchase of tobacco illegal. So no smoking in this country, in Asia. Yeah, it's very hard, and I didn't even know this country, again, being a geographically challenged American. Kate, any insights?
Still thinking.
All right, well, I'm going to cheat a little bit, and I went to Google, and it's Bhutan.
You're right. Good job. Google is always your friend. Bhutan is right. And again, I didn't even know this country. It's a landlocked country, Bhutan, in South Asia between India and China. Kate, any familiarities with Bhutan?
I don't think they have e-discovery there.
So you haven't, that's not a place you frequented.
It's a very, very religiously Buddhist country and, in fact, really difficult to get to. So I think even as of recent times, there are limited flights in and out and lots of restrictions on having outsiders go in. So, but very interesting.
Well, there you go. They also make sure that there's no tobacco in that country. And like Kit said, probably limited e-discovery. So your travels don't take you there. You guys, this was fun. You know, Kate, I realize that it is almost 2 o'clock in the morning for you. And so I appreciate you staying awake and sounding awake for the ESI report today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
And Jason, as always, wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Michelle. We really appreciate it.
Well, that wraps up another edition of the ESI report. Thank you to everyone listening. And thanks to Kroll On Track for sponsoring another edition of the show. To learn more about recent e-discovery issues and trends, make sure you keep a pulse on industry developments at ediscovery.com. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track. Be sure to follow Kroll On Track on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll On Track software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.